In this episode, we engage in a very candid conversation about serious subjects, including but not limited to drugs and mental health, through the lens of the author's real-life experiences. Please be advised that the discussions may delve into sensitive topics that can be triggering for some listeners. The stories shared by our guests are personal and reflect their individual journey. While we aim to foster understanding and awareness, we are not mental health professionals, and our conversations are not a substitute for professional advice, diagnosis, or treatment. If you or someone you know is struggling with mental health issues or substance abuse, we encourage you to seek help from qualified professionals. Your well-being is paramount, and there are resources available to support you. Listener discretion is advised. Thank you for joining us on this journey. Hello, Prosecco Queens fam. I am your host, Teresa, and thank you for joining us for this new episode. So the people closest to me know that I am and have always been an avid reader. At any point in time, I'm reading at least 5 books at once that range from self-help to autobiographies and literally just about everything in between. And today I have the privilege of talking with Ryan Gray, who is the author of the book Twilight in York, Volume 1, whose story took me in from the very beginning. In the dim shadows of struggle and the relentless pursuit of hope, Ryan Gray emerged with a story that reflects the human spirit's capacity for perseverance. His memoir, a work of creative nonfiction, delves into the turbulent latter stages of addiction before finding a path to recovery in 2007. This deeply personal narrative isn't just an account of adversity, but a beacon of hope for others who walk a similar road. Through vivid storytelling, Ryan captures the rawness of addiction and the quiet strength required to overcome it. His journey demonstrates that there is a solution, and he is living proof of it. His memoir serves not only as a testimony to survival, but as a message to those still lost in the darkness. There's always a way out, and with it, the promise of a new beginning. I am looking forward to getting into the gritty details with Ryan, and because addiction touches every family in one way or another, including in my household. Regardless of economic standing, race, color, creed, or the multitude of ways we can diversify ourselves. I think this is not only an important story to tell, but one that will hopefully open minds and create a level of empathy that we all need for those who have or still may be struggling. I am pleased to introduce Ryan Gray, the author of Twilight in York, Volume 1. Welcome to the show, Ryan.
Hello. Thank you for having me. I appreciate being on the show. I really do. Thank you.
This book has really gripped me. I think that your storytelling is so unique at its best. I think it's raw. It's gritty. I think we mentioned before, I am enjoying it too much. And the reality is I feel bad saying that because it's your life story and it's real. And I don't want you to think I'm like, yeah, I'm enjoying what you went through, but the way you tell it is gripping. So if you don't mind telling me, telling our listeners, what made you feel so comfortable being so raw and personal in this storytelling? And how did it start? How did the idea of it start?
So it started out as a project for a class. It was a short story. I studied a literature creative writing. That's where I got my bachelor's. But it started out as a project for a class. It was a short story and where a student student suggested I write the whole story out frame by frame. This seemed like a golden idea. It was simple and yet so far reaching. To take the template, we would have these workshop classes. The most important part of being a creative writing major is the workshop classes because they give you writing assignments and you write them out and then we take turns critiquing each other's work. Just to take the template I had started with, which was a true story about an act on the street and run with it, turn it into a narrative by presenting it in chronological order, telling the whole story and leaving nothing out. So I got started in that class. And then I had a publisher, a local publisher for a few years. And as I was working with her, there was a feeling of sort of reaching out in a creative and artistic way. So there was sort of a purging of emotion or catharsis. I was helping others in a spiritual way, and the publisher was actually a Christian publisher. I'm not that big on Christianity, but she was a Christian publisher and she specialized in abuse. And we both kind of decided that addiction is a form of abuse. You could call it self-abuse.
Agreed.
But it is something. A big Kerouac fan, Jack Kerouac, he's my favorite author. And he's
and I don't know that I've read anything of his, actually, now that you're saying that. I don't know that I've read anything of his.
On the Road, but it's his biggest, most famous work.
Okay.
But what I wanted was something literary that was creative, that was artistic. But I also wanted to write something that carried the message of recovery. So my publisher at the time was really gung-ho about the recovery aspect. And I was considering for a while taking out the message of recovery and just having an artistic sort of literary book. She was very big about that, about reaching out, helping other people, just because of her background with the Christian thing and carrying the message. Sort of became more apparent, more kind of crystallized that was what I needed to do.
I understand that. And I don't want to cut you off, but I understand that in a sense. And, you know, like I can see, you know, definitely having some creative differences. You know, it's a little hard too when, you know, certain publishers, I can imagine, have a certain idea, right? You know, you have that back and forth. And I understand in her sense, the Christian part of it, because that's what gives people the hope, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, sometimes not every story works out that way, right? Like you were, I'm going to use the term blessed in that sense, because that's how I speak. That's how I would see it, right? And so I understand, but I also think sometimes, and this is the dichotomy of it, the other side of that, I think, is that not every story ends up like yours, right? So it's like sometimes you have to show the realities of the darkness in order to find that light, but not every story finds that light. And we've all lived, and I can probably say that with confidence, we all at some point, you know, we're all 6 degrees of separation, have known people who have not lived through the darkness into the light. You know what I'm saying? So it's that's a really interesting, I would say not an interesting choice for you, but I think that it's very between you and her. I think almost that it was a really good idea to have both of you put your voices in there, because that as you're reading it, you know, with this volume 1, I notice there is, and we'll talk about volume 2 later on, like how that's gonna be. But with volume 1, you can tell that there is times that you do exude a bit of hope, and you say, "Okay, I'm gonna do better this time. I'm not gonna do it this time. This is gonna be the one that works, and this is gonna be the time that works." And it's like, okay, that's it. I'm not going back to this again. And then, of course, the demon follows. You know, we know that. And again, we, like I said, in my own household, just recently, we had, and it wasn't me personally, and we had it in, you know, alcoholism and drug addiction in my household and other addictions that we won't go into. So I had to make those choices to say, unfortunately, the same choices that your family had to make, where it was, we can't do anything else anymore. You know what I'm saying? Like this, it's a personal decision, but we know for you, and we're going to talk about this as well, there was the mental health aspect of it, which to me, to be honest with you and my audience as well, is addiction of any kind that is a mental illness in itself. We all have certain addictions.
Right.
I've said before in other episodes, mine has always been like a food addiction, right? I've had food addiction. I've had exercise addiction. You know, I've had, what's the other one? Procrastination. That's not an addiction, but that's a mental issue. You know what I'm saying? When we all have things that we struggle with, and some worse than others. And I appreciate how throughout your book, you throw in those areas of, I got this time. I'm going to do better. And then you show that you're human and you fall back. Mm-hmm. I think that's really good. Again, I'm going to say storytelling, even though technically it's what you were living at the time.
Right.
What I want to do, because we want to talk about what your drug of choice was. I don't even know that I'm saying it properly. But what I want to do before we go into that is to have 3 small excerpts from your book that I want to read. And it kind of goes into the whole background of what we're going to talk about even more. And then you can, you know, obviously talk about what your drug of choice was. Because I know towards the end of the book, you talk about at that point, that was your drug of choice. But that didn't even matter. It was about, you know, it was about what was available, what you were doing, and what you and your cohorts were doing as well at the time. I wouldn't necessarily say friends, because I don't know, you know, if they ended up as, you know, if you can consider that friends or just people living the same life as you at the time. But at the time, it's just kind of like-minded people, right? That's really what it is. When I say, you know, courts, it was like-minded people. And no, each of you had a drug of choice. And then at the, at one point it was like, well, we're just going to do what we have available. I'm going to read the three of them and then we'll go from there. You know, our audience will enjoy it. I can guarantee you that. It was indeed my story. Each event was filtered through my own perspective. What actually happened immediately followed by the impression it made on me. Sometimes I was able to jot down an important detail. Before my excessive drug use, I always had a good memory. Everything in York took place somewhere between concrete, objective reality and my own inner world. Through all, the DXM definitely pushed me back further inside and agitated the state of my mental health. I had my initial hospitalization following the aforementioned break. I had jumped from a second story window, got up, and jumped again. It was then that I started to learn what drugs could do to a mentally ill brain. I stopped paying rent, as I was mostly broke. I was living in a half-finished basement at the time, about a mile from the main campus. When I had no money for food, cigarettes, or drugs, I started to steal. I stopped showering, shaving, brushing my teeth, no hygiene whatsoever. I remember attending class once while I was manic, thoughts racing. I was sure everyone in the world could smell me. At this time, I became irrational and had many confused, delusional conversations with my parents, asking them that I were there murders committed at our former home? Were they conspiring against me? Showing aggression and even making threats. They tried to coax me towards some stabilization by paying my rent and tuition, but only on the condition that I find a job, see a psychiatrist, stop using drugs, and achieve moderate grades. I became fully reclusive, would not answer the door or come out of my room. When I stole Robitussin cough medicine. I no longer had any friends or money, so I was short of a way to get high. I drank whole 8-ounce bottles with increasing frequency. The amount of dextromethorphan, DXM, in my blood was toxic on a regular basis. Because I had stopped taking care of myself, my room had rotten food, ants, broken glass, and a clogged toilet. My parents visited my room near campus and saw the way I was living, in squalor. They called the police and had them shuttle me to the nearest hospital. I went quietly. From there, I was processed, inserted into the system. My consciousness at that time was hard to determine. That's deep. That's deep down bottom. Do you feel that that was your bottom? Or was that just the beginning?
That was the beginning. That was the beginning. Mental health. I always thought the ratio I always had in my head was, you know, I'm downward. I'm on a downward spiral, but my downward spiral is about four times more rapid than theirs is, because being as mentally ill as I am, and I am very mentally ill, I have schizophrenia, depression, social anxiety, generalized anxiety, ADHD. Because I have all of that, you know, if I use or drink, my downward spiral is just much more rapid, much faster. So that excerpt about living in squalor, yeah, that was only the beginning. I mean, it got much worse very quickly.
And was that in your college? That was your college, like where you lived in college?
Yeah, that was my, I had to get pulled out of college for medical reasons. Mm-hmm. I think my dad called the dean and had him, like it was past the point where I could withdraw from the class. But I forget what the code was called. It was like an XX something where it says your grade is X. I don't remember what it was called, but he was able to get through to the dean and allow me to withdraw.
I didn't know the way past F, let alone down to X.
Yeah. Yeah, that was while I was in college. That's when it all started in college. My drug abuse, you know, it started with marijuana. I was never a huge drinker, but I did drink some. I used to smoke when I was in college. I used to smoke marijuana every day. The only brush I've had with the law was we got busted for drug paraphernalia. We didn't have enough. We only had a little bit of marijuana. So they couldn't charge us for possession,
right?
Which was very lucky because we always had a good amount, but this, we just happened to not really have much. So there was that. And then the psychotic break that you mentioned about,
right,
the jumping from the window, that was right around the time that I was using marijuana every day. And then I started taking Adderall. That's when I started taking DXM.
So it was like the gateways, basically. Yeah,
pretty much.
So why? And not that I encourage, it to get worse, obviously, but why DXM? Now, when I ask that question, it's interesting because I remember, for example, Lil Wayne years ago had, like, you know, passed out, had seizures. Things, they used to mix it with like Sprite. When things like that, I used to think to myself, first of all, you talk about Robitussin. That was one of the nastiest medicines. To this day, it is still one of the grossest medicines. But it's not about the taste of the medicine. It's about what it does for you.
The taste is actually because this pharmaceutical companies like Robitussin are trying to deter people from abusing it by making it taste really bad.
Makes sense. Yeah. I know you talk about in your book how schizophrenia basically is really like the devil's work. And those were your words. And I could completely understand and agree with that. I guess if bipolar hit my house and with the drug use, it just exacerbated the mania, right? And it started with marijuana, but it went to alcohol and other addictions at that point as well. So for you, did DXM give you what just that high that you needed to calm down? Based on the book, it seems like it was kind of like there were times that it was made to kind of calm you down and just take you out of your head because of the mental illness. Was that what the pull was from it?
You know, that's a good question. It's kind of a chicken before the egg, thing is, did the mental health cause the addiction or the other way around?
Got it.
I started using it because, you know, especially if I was like, I would find myself broke and I would be in new areas. So even if I did have the money, I wouldn't know where to buy drugs from or who to buy drugs from. So what I would do is I would steal it from a drugstore. And there's actually a lot of, become a pretty big problem with teenagers because it's so easy to get. One time when I went to buy DXM, there was like a person at a computer and she had a system, and I don't know if it was just that county or just that state, but they kept track of how many bottles of Robitussin you had bought like in the past month.
They did start doing that around the nation, actually. I remember that. Yes. Yeah. Wow. So I guess that makes sense. I mean, I wouldn't have thought about it that way, that it's just basically a supply and demand situation, right? Like if you need it, you're going to find a way to get it. You know what I'm saying? I guess I didn't really think about that. And that kind of actually takes me to my next point, which is interesting. When your story begins, for volume one, when your story begins, you talk about how you are let off in York, Pennsylvania for a halfway house. Mm-hmm. Interestingly enough, I had never heard of York, but I know it's not far from Hershey, and I've been to Hershey a few times. And for me, that's only an hour and a half away, actually, barely 2 hours from where I live. I was just at Hershey a year ago. So in that sense, so the way you describe York is interesting, almost like it's a character in itself in the book. Was that a conscious choice, or was that just because you just happen to be there at that point in time when you were getting towards your lowest or trying to get better at the same time? Do you think that if it was another place, it might have been just as significant? Because I don't know anything about York, but the way you talk about York surprised me, actually, to be honest with you. I wouldn't have known it to be such an urban environment the way you describe it.
So York has a high minority population, or I honestly don't know if it's the whole of York. The places where I was staying, the parts of towns where I was, and I feel like the rest of York was a high minority population, and the street life persona was new to me. I had to allow myself to be impacted by it, to let it change me. I had a CD wallet full of alternative rock and metal, but the average citizen in New York was more of a hip hop or like a bop identity I was not familiar with. And if I was familiar with it, I was not familiar with being surrounded by it, with it being the MO of the area. It's different. I don't know if you remember the Superman song. It's a hip hop song, and it was very popular at the time. And I was amazed how many people were playing that song. It's different for a white guy to be surrounded by mostly black people all the time. It required a lot of adjustment and alterations to my most basic central identity. Most of my friends were black. The second main character is Puerto Rican. But I was welcomed with open arms. I was treated as one of the fold by my new friends than any of my previous friends. Mm. I found them to be more cordial and compassionate. One group let me sleep on an inflatable mattress in their basement for free for months. Very little was asked of me, but the transition from alternative rock as a white boy to hip hop was hardcore. I remember nearly throwing my CD wallet off the bridge over the Critters Creek. There was a sense of brotherhood between people on the street, and I never felt discriminated against or mistreated for being white. Quite the opposite, in fact. The setting I was in was a cultural one, a culture that goes unaccepted, and it's something I want to talk about too, the unaccepted, unacknowledged, swept under the rug. Yet we have our own music and our own Argo. We are pretty much the underbelly of the beast, likened to system warts. People try to avoid us, but the sense of culture in places like York is profound. I was trying to describe the city's atmosphere, and people I encountered there influencing me. York sort of as an overarching reality. But I was amazed, like, you know, and maybe this is my failure to do good, you know, so I kind of looked online, like Googled and looked at YouTube pages, and I was able to find very little about street life, especially as a culture. I discovered a whole culture that was very apparent to me as I was living within it, you know, in York with mostly black people.
It's very interesting, I think, because a lot of times we get put into situations that we either weren't raised in or weren't expecting to. And human nature is to adapt, right? Is to adapt, is to try to survive and adapt. And I know there's a few scenes in there where you meet up with a few gangs of people that you're not quite sure how to handle at first. And then they seem to, you know, and what it does when you're reading it is it kind of keeps you on edge. You wonder as you're reading it, is this going to be like a jail situation where like you have to do certain things for your own survival, to, you know, join certain groups, certain gangs for your own survival, for protection? And it doesn't necessarily always turn out that it doesn't turn out that way, which is really interesting to me. It's like you kind of go back and you're like, wait a second, they didn't have the intentions that I thought that they were going to have in the beginning. And it seems to be a theme throughout the book, which I thought was really interesting. One of the things that I enjoy, you just talked about, you know, the Puerto Rican, your Puerto Rican friend, which is just funny, weirdly enough, but you describe this relationship with him. And I want to assume it's who you're talking about. So I'm not going to say the name, that I'll leave that to you if you want to do that. But he became like a brother to you. How did having him by your side impact your journey? Because it's always interesting when you find people that are not just necessarily, I won't say like-minded, but are at a different point in their struggle, that they can take somebody under their wing who is deeply struggling. So for you, what did this bond mean to you with this person? And by the way, do you still keep in contact with this person?
I tried to make an archetypal, like I said, I'm big on Kerouac and the Beat Generation. On the Road sort of has a extroverted kind of prison felon mentality character. Kind of refers to him as an urban cowboy. He's known for, you know, doing things like, you know, driving from California to New York in 4 days, not sleeping, high energy, charismatic. And I wanted to represent that Puerto Rican main character as a archetype of him. A person's name in real life is the person Oh, the archetypal person was Neil Cassidy, or in the book On the Road, Nick. He's given the name Dean Moriarty. He's given the name Cody Pomeroy in other books. But he is the, I feel like my friend is the embodiment of the urban, street-worn New England cowboy, like charismatic, always by my side. We looked after each other as we were both on the streets trying to survive. He was selfless with me. He never asked for anything but from me but the butt of the cigarette I was finished with. Shared his friends and copped whatever drug we were after. His existence at my side kept me relatively safe. The folks who let me sleep in their basement were friends of his, so we had a hand in that too, my homeless status. Without him, I would have been aimless, purposeless. I would have no direction. Without him, there would be no story, and I would probably be dead from overdose, like many of my friends from that time were. Most of my friends that I used with at that time actually passed away from overdose. They were heroin addicts. The main character, his name's Alexander, given the nickname Mac. He was a very unique type of addict because, like, for example, I knew somebody who smoked one cigarette a day, and I didn't understand how they were able to do that. Mac was the type that, you know, he would use harder drugs, but not get hooked on them.
He had a different level of tolerance for certain uses and certain drugs and others. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It seems like that's definitely a mental thing as well. That's also, to me, that's very indicative of, to me, that's actually indicative of hardcore, because that means that, like, you not only have control over your mental and what, you know what I mean, what you're doing. Some things are more of a choice than others, I think. That's interesting to hear of that, because you're right. I know some people that also say, oh, I only smoke one a day, or, you know, I only have one after I eat, for example, just a cigarette. We know how highly addictive nicotine is, right? And I'm going to say right now, based on these other addictions, I'll say it's a lower addiction. We know it's just as bad, as terrible. Regardless of that, we know that I say the same thing. I'm like, how have you not gotten to the point that you are a complete pack-a-day smoker or two-pack-a-day smoker? And for me, I think that's a very strong mental. That's a very strong mental, because it's still, you still have that addiction in the sense of you still have to have it after every meal, for example, or once a day, right? It's more, it's very habit. It's a habit-forming issue. Mm. And I think that's the same, that might be the same idea with your friend. He didn't get to the point necessarily of it being habit forming. He was able to say, oh, I can dabble in this and I can dabble in that and I can dabble at this and still go on with my life. But he was still to the point that he was in a similar situation as you. So that just shows that there's levels of mental illness and addiction easily.
He very unique. I mean, like, in my travails, I've met a lot of addicts, and it's very rare to see somebody who's in complete control, even if he's trying, like, cocaine or heroin. But most people, once they try heroin, they never put it down.
Yes. And it's terrifying.
And he's able to do heroin and not want it again for a couple of weeks, if that.
Which is really dangerous too, isn't it? Something like heroin, I mean, they're all dangerous. What you were using was building up in your system, right? That's extremely dangerous. Something like heroin is like, you don't do it for a few weeks, a few months or whatever, and your body doesn't have the same tolerance. And you know what I mean? You think you can use the same amount, and God forbid, you know what I'm saying? Yeah. So, you know, that's how a lot of people, unfortunately, succumb to that addiction, is because of that. Do you consider DXM addiction, the cough suppressant, the gateway to other things for you? Or that just was, no matter what, that's what you chose to do, even when you tried other things?
I don't think I was, like I said, you know, I would be in a new area without any money. And it became my drug of choice, because out of default.
It was just access.
Yeah, because I couldn't find anybody. And I guess that changed when I was in York, and I did actually start to make friends there.
Right.
But it was very easy to do, easy to get. In fact, I was doing so much of it that it was making me sick because I was abusing, I started abusing Coracetin, which has the same active ingredient as Robitussin. That's the DXM. But I didn't know it at the time, but later on I researched it, and your liver enzymes, basically, what is it called? The Coracetin stays in your system for longer.
It doesn't break it down.
Yeah, it doesn't break it down the same way. And so a lot of people don't realize that if you're going to do Coracetin, you know, you're going to have to slow down a little bit because it can be a couple of days later and it's still in your body, even if you don't experience it mentally, but it's there.
A lot of these medicines, the ones that we take every day, I take medicine every day for other reasons, and they have different half-lives, and those half-lives are what stay within your system. And that's the point, right? Because your body's slow releasing them. Your body doesn't have the ability to break certain medicines down just like that. And that is how you know, that you're able to actually have these issues. And I think at one point, like I said, to everybody, I have the book. I know Ryan had sent me the ebook, but I wanted to buy the book because I love to actually have a book and read it and take notes and everything else. And later on, you can tell our audience where they can get the book if they want to do that. But the point of that was, I'm about 3/4 of the way through. I wanted to read it as close to our interview as possible. But I did notice at some point, I see some point, you did end up in the hospital because what it did to you.
And I had a hard time convincing people that I needed to go to the hospital. It was like, I would tell people, and like, I think my breaking point was we were at McDonald's, and I think I ate like 4 French fries and wasn't able to hold it down and threw up. And like, that's how sick I was. And they were finally like, okay, we'll take you to the a mixed blessing, because on the one hand, you know, I was getting help. I was going to the hospital. I was addressing while I was sick. On the other hand, it kind of really messed with the way that people looked at me and treated me. Like, I was being treated as some hospital patient that was weak and sick and couldn't drink, couldn't use without getting sick, and that I needed to be looked after, supervised. And it was just a lot. You know, it's almost like it might have been better not to go to the hospital, but
maybe not necessarily, because then you might not be here to tell the story. You know, you heard, for example, and I don't know if obviously you followed, but like with Matthew Perry, for example, you know, before obviously his untimely demise just recently, you know, he had taken so many pills at some point that his stomach was basically had exploded in a sense, you know. And
I saw that. Almost,
yeah. And his book was fantastic too. And it talks about being lucky and wondering why certain people make it through certain things and others don't. You know, and I find it interesting that, you know, even though we're all very hard-headed, we're like, oh, I don't need to go to the hospital. You know when you're not feeling right. And it takes a lot for most of us to admit that we have a problem, to admit that we need help. So let me ask you something. I just want to go back real quick to York. You were staying in a halfway house there. Were you, if you don't mind me asking, before that, how did you get to York? Like, where did that come into play where you got to York? Like, where were you beforehand that they said, this is the place you should be?
So, obviously, you know, I was sort of in and out of treatment. I would always find a way to get kicked out, you know, like, for example, when I was at the a mental ward for, I think it was 4 months, I was finding ways to get to the store to steal Robitussin. And at one point, I scaled the fence and went over. And this was in a mental ward where we're not allowed to leave.
Wow.
So I escaped.
Because you weren't there voluntarily. No. You were committed. Okay. Okay.
Yeah. And I was sort of facilitated. I mean, I was put through the system. I went to different treatment facilities. My parents would put a line up treatment facilities. Eventually I got to where I was going to rehab. 14 days went by and I said, okay, I'm done. I don't want to be here anymore. And it was strongly recommended that I stay, you know, for the full 28 days and I wouldn't have it. So they said, okay, pulled out the big binder and looked for available halfway houses. I was in Maryland at the time. And they found a halfway house in York, Pennsylvania to attend. They drove me up there in the van. And I got out of the van and went to this halfway house and moved in. And my substance abuse just continued. And I had some willpower about trying not to use once I got there.
Well, I can say that I think for me, willpower, right? And again, we are not comparing apples to oranges, right? Because there's mental illness, there's addiction. There's addiction, like I said, to, you know, to things like food, there's addiction to drugs, and anything can really be turned into an addiction, right? Like that you, because willpower. Now, I do think that at times they go hand in hand. When you have something like a drug addiction, I can only imagine that the willpower it would take that the drug use wins out, because you know there's less, you know that there's knowledge around how it's going to make you feel, and the known is better than the unknown. Do you think that has something to do with, for yourself at least, for wanting to continue using? It's just a level of, sure, I can use my willpower and I can try my hardest and stop, or I can just say, screw it, I'm in this situation, I know how I want to feel, and this gets me there, I'm going to continue using.
I think thing about willpower is it's like not going to help you much in the long run with addiction. It's sort of one of the best arguments for having a higher power is that we all try to give it up cold turkey. We all try to use our willpower to get past it, and you know it requires a higher power to sort of alter that situation a little bit. I always reasoned that, you know, you mentioned battling, or one in 10,000 chance or something like that. You know, needing a higher power, because every time I step in the ring with addiction, I lose my willpower. I mean, most addicts have tried that. They've tried willpower, and you need that higher power to sort of balance the equation a little bit.
To be grounded. We all need to be grounded, and we need something higher to ground us.
Mm-hmm.
That's definitely how I see it. I've said that a bunch of times actually on this podcast, is it for me, again, and being a family member, wife of sorts at this point, but more of a estranged wife at this point, seeing your family member, someone you care for, going through that and knowing there's nothing else you can do for it's very hard, not just on the person obviously, but on the family. And I know one point in your book you actually say that when you're in that struggle, when you're in that addict state of mind, you think it's all about you and you don't realize the damage you do to the, you know, to mm-hmm. the people that care about you. But it doesn't, but it's not that you don't care. It's that you're at that point, it's just, that's what it is. And I understand that, being, again, the family member of someone who has mental illness, which, you know, got exacerbated by alcohol and drugs as
well. Yeah, that's what happened to me.
Yeah, and it's understandable, you know. And coming from the other side of that, it's heartbreaking to see somebody you love and care about go through. We are free-willed people, individuals. That's how we were created. So when you're not able, you know, and it's not always even in a drug situation, but when you're not able to, you know, have somebody conform to what you want them to be, whatever the case may be, you know, it causes that tension as well. So that's it's really, really hard, you know, and I can see it from both, you know, obviously from both sides. We're getting closer to the end, but I wanted to ask you, because I know we didn't talk about it, and it's a huge part of your book, is how you worked as a temp in Hershey. In one of their candy plants, if I'm understanding that correctly, it was one of their candy plants based on what you were describing in the book. What I did not get out of the book is, and it may be in volume two, which I'll ask you about in a bit, but what exactly, when you were working there, and I know you were struggling hard through that and going, and you know, the people weren't the most pleasant either, because you were all temps. There was different races there, languages, people just trying to get some money and get through the day. How does that exactly end up? I mean, do you end up permanent there? Do you end up staying there? I mean, like, you know, I'm curious as to what ends up, and you don't have to go into a lot of detail if you want. I mean, you have to finish reading the book to find out, I'm sure. But were you ever there full time? Like, it just seems like there was a lot going on that factory where you were working, and I'm just curious how that ended up for you.
Yeah, the temp agency I worked for was kind of like on a rotation, where one day they would send you somewhere and another day they would send you somewhere else. So I worked at the Hershey plant for I don't know how many weeks, maybe like a month.
That was it, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then sort of get, you know, yeah, it's very much like the supervisor of the temp agency will call out in the morning and find out what places need people and send people to the places that are needed. And it's really inconsistent with where I'm actually going to work.
Interesting. That makes sense that you're saying that, because the way you have the book broken down is like months at a time. It's such a gripping, almost character, kind of like the way you described York, almost like a character. It almost feels like you were there for forever. So it's really interesting the way you describe your days in the factory, that I almost felt like it was, when you just like a month, I'm like, my goodness, I felt like it was like a year you were there. And at one point they talk about maybe making you a permanent, you know, making you a permanent position. And I assume that didn't happen. The last thing I do want to ask you, and I don't want to necessarily say that we discussed it before, but looking back at the person you were during the events of the book, being that was, I believe, 2007, how do you see that version of yourself now? Like, how do you look back at that version of yourself now?
I don't think that writing has changed how I view my past. I was a no good junkie with no regard for the suffering of others, especially my parents. I was delusional, partly because I was not seeing a doctor for my mental illness about right and wrong and the nobility of what I was doing or using. Then I got help and all that changed. This prognosis has been the same ever since I got clean. Today, I'm less delusional, and I care about the well-being of others. Twilight is almost like a truth serum, in hopes of hitting readers with the truth, but I did not need to write it to understand this.
Interesting. Very interesting. So if you could look back now, and this is right off the cuff of my head, if you could look back now and tell yourself something back then, do you have any idea what that would be? A piece of advice, a piece of hope? I mean, anything at the time, you know, that you might want to tell yourself back then?
Yeah, I would probably tell myself to take my medication.
Oh, amen. Yeah.
To accept help sooner.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
That's a good one. Because so many, and again, when I say so many people, I mean so many of us sometimes feel where we can either do it ourselves, we're above that, or we don't need it. And sometimes there is no other way to get it, you know, to get your life together. So my last question for you, given that this is volume one. Can you give us a glimpse of what readers can expect in the subsequent volumes? How will your story evolve from here? And when might we be looking into volume two?
So volume two is supposed to come out in February of next year, all written and polished and everything. A publisher will probably find more corrections to make, but it's a bit.
They do, I'm sure.
Is that? Sorry.
No, they usually do, I'm sure.
Yeah, that's volume two. It really has a resolution. Like, for instance, my mom and dad wanted to write an epilogue for volume one because they thought that it needed some direction, needed some explanation of kind of what I was going for in volume one with the reaching out to others and sobriety and all that. Volume two is a sort of a resolution of volume one. The end of volume two, I eventually leave York. My mom and my brother pick me up from York and take me back to Baltimore. And I finally, you know, accept help. And the end of volume two is my ultimate sobriety date. So that was back in, you know, 2007. I've been clean since 2007.
Amen. That's fantastic. That's fantastic. And I'm looking forward to reading volume two. So I think I mentioned this before, you have to let me know, and then I can always do a follow-up and let our readers know as well. I think the fact that it's so raw made it relatable.
I get that compliment a lot, that it's raw.
It is. Yeah. It is a compliment. Because putting yourself out there is not easy.
Oh, I know. Yeah, like I thought it would be super easy because I try to be open. My opinion on being open, especially if you're in recovery, is that it's easier to be open than to worry about who knows what, or who knows that you attend AA meetings. And like, I know a lot of people that would probably be mortified if, you know, their friends knew that they went to AA. I just find it easier to have openness.
How are you feeling today? I mean, like, if you could look yourself in the mirror, or if you did, and based on what you've been through, how are you feeling today? Are you hopeful? Are you planning for the future? Are you just taking it one day at a time? I always say we should always take everything one day at a time. But I mean, for yourself, mentally, physically, emotionally, spiritually, whatever it may be, how are you feeling today?
I don't remember the exact words, but somebody said something along the lines of things are okay, or things are pretty good, and pretty good is good enough compared to some of the things that I've been through. I think, I live the life that I live today is a great, great success. So I'm grateful for that. Sure. I was going to ask you if I could read another excerpt of my own.
Oh my God, please do, please.
This is from chapter one. When they finally went to bed, I lay there feeling alive. The sounds on the street carried in through the open windows, though it had died down into the late hours of the night. Silent but for an occasional car driving past, a drunk or a whore yelling down the street corridors, shrill voices lamenting, undulating, penetrating through every open window for blocks, coloring dreams as the city slept. Outside, the world was alight in an eerie bright orange glow from the street lamps. The old, dirtied windows blurred and refracted the light, accentuated it, making the whole world orange. A breeze came in through the open windows, and it felt cool and good. The sounds of locusts were serene and in harmony. The balmy air had cleansed that funky indoor stuffiness smell created by the three of us in a tight space, and cleared away the musty smell sealed in the old house. And as the air filled the room, I fell asleep on a soft cloud of tranquility.
The pure vision that you get when listening to that or when reading it is so tangible almost.
Can I read one more?
Yes, you can definitely read one more.
I appreciate that. Thank you. I appreciate your praise, and that means a lot, especially because you're such a avid reader.
Thank you.
Okay. This is chapter 11. We were supposed to meet at the same tattoo parlor, the one next to the meeting, our usual spot, and she made me promise I would come. It was the first and only time we planned to do something beyond spend time in her garage and look at tattoo art, like an unofficial date. I took the bus to where we were meeting an hour late. I saw her through the window waiting for me, but I did not get off. And I saw the look on her face as the bus drove past. When it hit her, I was not coming. I saw such pain and terror on her face, a loneliness. She knew when she saw the doors closed, when I did not get off, that I was not coming. And she knew what it meant. Of course she did. I really hoped to God she did know, because I had stood her up. I was afraid I had broken her heart. I saw Lenore's face as I had mine. It was a face of utter dejection, of heartbreak indescribable I knew I had caused. A face of loss, like the faces of denizens after a town had been burned to the ground or swallowed up in a tidal wave. Catastrophes carrying away all the ash and smoke of memories. Loss, tremendous loss, desperately clutched at in the biting cold. I saw in her face whatever crude, despairing, mortal pain preceded grief. And no words may contain little, for in their utter failure at the task, their practice and art proven a tremendous lacking. Their work is not even enough to betray a semblance of what I saw. Here, her face, pale and flushed, was a beautiful morose medley. An ode about an ocean with its bottom carved out by a dull rusted blade. Her eyes were downcast, tethered by the immense, impalpable.
It does talk about a few, I'll say, relationships that you had while under the influence. And with Lenore, especially, and I'm still getting through your story with Lenore, actually reading it at this point. You do mention in the very beginning how you have some, I'll use the words regrets, but that might not be the correct word, of the way things worked out with her and the way that you felt you treated her. Is that along the correct lines based on the way that you described your relationship with her? First of all, she was very forward, it seems. She was a very, very independent, forward woman.
Yes, I thought, you know, and that was part of the fictionalization. I felt like I had developed a relationship with her. I just sort of bailed but backed out of it. Seeing her through the window, I think that was probably a fictionalized way. I could get into fictionalization. You know, I don't remember exactly how it played out, but I did, you know, kind of back out. I stopped talking to her. And I didn't know exactly how attached she was.
Yeah. All these years later, is she okay? Do you know?
No, I don't know. The only person I was able to contact was Mac or Alexander. Wasn't doing so good. He had some court dates and jail time. And
sorry to hear that.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a road that shouldn't be for anybody. Realistically, we know it's part of the human experience, but it shouldn't be for anybody. You know, that's an existence that is hard to imagine if you're not in the mind of somebody who is in that space. Does that make sense?
I think so. You're saying just the struggles of going to jail.
Well, jail is a part of it, sure, right? Like, there's jail, there's There's doing specific things that some people do to get access to their drug of choice, you know, to get money for their drug of choice, to sustain the addiction, to the mental illness that comes with it, to losing family members and the support because of it. And, you know, and not knowing every day with the homelessness as well, how you're going to survive on top of trying to sustain this addiction. It can be a very hard, you know, you'll hear some people say, well, just don't do drugs. And I've heard that myself. It doesn't work that way. You know, it does not work that way. Oh, why can't they just stop? It's kind of like if you're in an abusive relationship, why didn't they just leave?
Yeah, that's the stigma. Like I've talked to addicts that, you know, have held up stores, and there's a distinction between, you know, a criminal wants money and they hold up a store for money. And I've heard of addicts talking about, you know, they have a gun in their hand and they literally watch themselves raise the gun at somebody, and their arm as it goes up is being propelled by craving, by addiction, not propelled by, because
it's not the evil intent of just trying to do whatever a criminal may do. This is yeah. Just out of,
it's like not his arm. Like it's not.
It's like watching yourself as another person, like watching someone else do it almost.
Yeah. Pretty much.
Unbelievable. Thank you so much, Ryan, for being on with me. Ryan, please tell our listeners where they can get more info on you, and where they can buy the book if they choose to.
So I have a Facebook. If you look up my name, Ryan Gray, and it's got the Twilight in York banner on the top. I have a website, twilightinyork.com, which has some more information on the book and has a link to Amazon. The easiest way to buy the book is on Amazon. So you just get on Amazon and type Twilight in York and it'll come up.
And leave a review as well, because that helps, I'm sure.
Yes. Leave a review. That helps a lot.
Awesome. And as always, to our listeners, you can reach me at proseccoqueenspodcast@gmail.com for any info, questions, comments, or if you have a story you'd like to tell and are interested in possibly being a guest. I'm available at Prosecco Queens Podcast on IG and TikTok, as well as on YouTube, where you can watch and listen. Please like, subscribe, review, and share. We can continue growing with your continued support, which I'm grateful for. I'm also grateful for my guest today. Before we go, remember, if you or someone you know is struggling with addiction, recovery, or thoughts of suicide, help is always within reach. Call the National Helpline for Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services at 1-800-662-HELP or 1-800-662-4357, or reach the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline at 988. You're not alone, and there's always hope. Thank you again to Ryan for being here and telling us your story, and to our listeners for joining us. And we'll see you next time on Ride or Die from Teens to Prosecco Queens. Stay strong, stay connected, and remember, your story isn't even close to over yet. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Thank you.